This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another new episode of New Books in Islamic Studies, which is part of the New Books Network. I'm one of your co-hosts, Shobana Xavier, and I hope you are staying well and safe wherever you are, and thank you so much for joining me today. In today's episode, we are joined by the editors of Producing Islams in Canada, A Knowledge, Positionality, and Politics, Dr. Amélie Barras, who's an associate professor in the Department of Social Science at York University, Dr. Jennifer Selby, an associate professor in the Department of Religious Studies and an affiliate member of the Department of Gender Studies at Memorial University, and Dr. Melanie Adrian, an associate professor in the Department of Law and Legal Studies at Carleton University. The new edited volume brings together 29 interdisciplinary scholars of all levels to engage and reflect on how Islam and Muslims in Canada have been studied from the 1970s to the present moment. Stemming out of a workshop that brought together many of the scholars, the contributors were asked to reflect on diverse approaches to the study of Islam in Canada that center gender, race, religion, class, and much more. This edited volume is an important contribution to the field of Islam and Muslim studies in Canada, as it provides a necessary introspective survey of the state of the field while attending to regional diversities of Muslim communities, and also contains wonderful interviews with several senior scholars in the field. It also introduces disciplinary approaches to the study of Islam and Muslims. The scholarship here will be of interest to any scholar and student who's thinking of Muslim presence in the global West, not just in Canada, while chapters that attend to methodological reflections, such as the sections on positionality, will be particularly insightful pedagogical tools to utilize in methods courses, while other chapters also attend to how certain projects are funded and others are not, which lead to the knowledge production of any study, but in this particular case, on Muslims and Islam in Canada. In our conversation today, the editors and I spoke about how this project emerged, the state of the field of Islam and Muslim studies in Canada, and of course, potential future trajectories that a new generation of scholars are embarking upon. Questions around who produces knowledge on this area and what gets funded, which then of course informs the knowledge production and the knowledge that is consumed. And of course, nuances around nuances of Islamophobia and anti-Muslim racism, gendered Islamophobia and anti-Muslim racism as well, and much more. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Amélie, Jennifer, and Melanie about their new edited volume, Producing Islam in Canada, A Knowledge, Positionality, and Politics, which is published by the University of Toronto Press and just came out in 2021. Hi, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us to talk about your new edited volume, Producing Islams in Canada, A Knowledge, Positionality, and Politics. How are you all doing?
Very well. Thank you very much. Yeah. Fabulously.
So happy to have you and have three of you together. So I'm looking forward to the conversation. We have a tradition on the New Books podcast to start with a little bit of an autobiographical note. So I wonder if we could hear a little bit about maybe what led to this project and what led to actually your collaborating with each other. Melanie, did you want to go first?
Sure. So we have been working on this book since 2016 is actually when we started talking about it. And then that led to the, on the road, led us on the road to the workshop, the short grant, the workshop, which then led to the, to this volume. And we knew each other, we knew each other about each other's work and what we had done in the past. And I think we were all just really interested in thinking about what was happening in Canada specifically in terms of the study of Islam. When did we start really producing knowledge on Islam in Canada? What did it look like? We wanted to interrogate that question a little bit more. And so I think that's what really brought us together, that central question that actually drives the entire volume.
Great. Jennifer, did you want to add?
Yeah, thanks for asking. So for me, some of these questions first emerged back in around 2014, 2015, when I was co-authoring a different book with Emmy Lee and a different co-author, Laurie Beeman, called in a book called Beyond Accommodation that came out in 2018. And so for that book, together we really wanted to see what had been written so far. And so started this bibliographical project that we then took up and continued on in the workshop and in this edited volume. And so it was really just a desire to not only undertake that literature review kind of amongst ourselves, but to engage and interpolate and think with other scholars about what was there and what wasn't there and why.
Yeah. And I guess for me, I think Jennifer and Melanie have summed it quite well. I think it's also related to the work that I had done in the past. And it was a reflection that started in Beyond Accommodation, the book that we wrote with Jennifer and Laurie, where we, you know, I worked in the past a lot on Turkey and France and headscarf bans. And there had been a lot of, and we saw in 2014, 2015, a lot of scholarship on these questions around headscarf bans, Sharia debates in Ontario. And so the scholarship seemed to be driven by policy in many ways as well and debates. And we were wondering, so we wanted to reflect on that. What questions do we tackle as scholars and have we tackled as scholars and more generally scholars in Canada? And what questions remain invisible and why and the politics around that? So that's also, and I think that's a question that really drives the volume as well, to think about what's visible and what remains invisible and why. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so.
Yeah, I mean, I think the service you've done for scholars on, you know, Islam and Muslims in Canada is immense, especially with this book, the working bibliography that you have online. So I'm really excited to have this conversation and talk about kind of both the present and the future. We should also probably say a little bit about where you're institutionally located and introduce yourselves in terms of maybe, that as well. So Emily, do you want to go first?
Yeah, so I'm actually located now at York University in Toronto in the social science department, but I teach in the law and society program. So although I come from a background in political science, now most of my work touches on the questions of law and religion. And I've been at York since 2015 or 2014, but previously I was in Europe. So I think that sort of shapes my work in many ways because I have I tend to work in with a comparative lens and think about Canada comparatively as well. Yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah. Melanie, did you want to go next?
Sure. I'm in the Department of Law and Legal Studies at Carleton University, and I really come at these issues from a legal anthropology perspective as well as religious studies, even though I'm in a law department. So I do a bit of everything.
Yeah, fantastic. Jennifer.
And yeah, and I'm at Memorial University of Newfoundland and Labrador, which is on the lands of the Beatuk and the Mi'kmaq. And I'm in a religious studies department and, was hired to think about Islam and in Islam and Muslims in Canada particularly. So it does lend itself well to this project. But one of the things that I think is really exciting about kind of taking this snapshot on this topic, if you will, is that we really have been engaging with all kinds of scholars across disciplines. And so one of the things that we noted, I guess one of the takeaways in our bibliographical project is that a lot of the work is sociological, but readers can take a look at some of our graphs and see it's really astounding, actually, the number of different disciplines that have thought and written about this topic.
Yeah, I think the interdisciplinarity of the scholarship and the scholars and the angles from which they're bringing their own lens to the study is, I think, fantastic. We have quite a bit of an international audience. And so I think I wonder, and I know this is a hard question because this is kind of the crux of what you're doing. But I mean, if for folks who haven't really thought about Canadian Islam or maybe are based in, Europe, or the US, maybe what are some things that they should think about as we have this conversation of, Islam and Muslims in Canada? I know that's a big question. I don't know if somebody wants to tackle it, but
I mean, I can say a little bit about it, but it's more that the book, we've tried in the book, because the book is really, many of the chapters are specifically on questions of Islam and Muslims in Canada, but we tried in the first section of the book to have scholars intervene in the discussion that are not actually scholars working in Canada or on these questions in Canada, and to show that the questions we ask in the book about knowledge production are questions that actually scholars working on Islam and Muslims everywhere and on other disciplines should actually be thinking and asking themselves about. And so we have a piece by Shirin Amir Mwazami, and she speaks about that in that piece very elegantly about Europe and about production of knowledge around Islam and Muslims in Europe, which really echoes the questions we asked throughout the volume. And there's also an interview with Lara Deeb, who has worked on these questions on the Middle East, and she's located in the US. So her interview is mainly about the US, but it echoes what we do in the rest of the book. So we're hoping that with this sort of first part of the volume, the reader then can just see that the questions we're asking are actually questions that are valid to think about these questions, not only in Canada, but beyond. So we'll see. Yeah.
I would just add that to me, one of the interesting pieces is also to think not only about what is Islam or who are Muslims in Canada, but what is Canada in this literature? And here we try to think a little bit about that. And one of the things that Amélie and I do in our own chapter, thinking about qualitative literature, is to really show, with Laurie Beeman, is to really show the shift actually in some of that literature and how the category of Canada is examined. And I think now we're starting to see a lot more critical scholarship about the multicultural model, about the way that religious minorities figure and so on. So that's one piece. And another piece in thinking about the Canadian part is to know a little bit about, what is Islam and who are Muslims in Canada? And then to think about what has not been examined, right? And so definitely a big lacunae has been the historical piece. There has not been that much historical work that has been undertaken. And so it's quite something, right? We don't know that much about the first, the early slave trade and Black Muslims. There has been very little, with the exception of Afua Cooper's work, very little written on that topic, for example. Other work like Sufism, really excited about your book, Shabana, that's going to come out soon. That's going to be a huge contribution. But Mina Sharifi Funk and Jason Idris Sparks, they write a piece in the volume that really talks about Sufism in Canada. So we know that obviously Sufis are in Canada, but there has been very little scholarship about it. So I think that maybe scholars outside of Canada will see resonances with gaps that they know exist in the literature and see those in our book as well.
Fantastic. Melanie, did you want to add anything or?
See, the problem that I face working with two brilliant women, Shauna, is that when you come third, there's often very little to add. So, no, and I think the only comment I have, and it's more of a summary really, is to say there are larger theoretical issues that we address that really have really important cross-cutting lessons here internationally. And then there are some pieces that are very specifically tailored to Canada. So I think it does some work in all of those spheres.
Yeah, and I think that's a great way to think about it, especially in terms of the way that the book is sectioned off in four different sections, the interviews that are featured. I really love that. And I would love to hear about maybe how that idea came up to interview senior scholars or important figures in kind of this landscape of scholarship. So maybe we could get into some of the sections. So we could start with section one. And section one is about knowledge production. You have some great interviews here with some important scholars. I really was drawn to Aaron Hughes's contribution here. And I think it's a really important one, I think, in terms of stating some of the politics behind the production of knowledge that we don't often think about or actually reflect on. So I wonder, I mean, I'm highlighting this one chapter, but there's so many different chapters in this section. But if somebody wants to discuss what Aaron Hughes is doing, and SHRC is this funding organization that we have in Canada that funds federally funds a lot of projects from PhD students to master's students to having chairs at institutions that actually produce the knowledge. So just as a preface to some of our international listeners as well. But,
yeah, I was really thrilled when Aaron agreed to write this chapter. And I think he's the right person to do it for a number of reasons. But I think it's really fascinating, right? Obviously, funding is not apolitical. And he really makes a case and shows how certain projects have been funded. We don't know, of course, which projects have not been funded, but it's kind of an imaginary exercise. And definitely, definitely check it out, that chapter. But just a little spoiler, I mean, it's really interesting to see, right, the kind of interest in questions of integration or problematic Islam on Sharia and on hijabs and these kinds of projects, of which I also have been part, right? So I include myself in that group of scholars who have received this kind of funding.
You go for it. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I just maybe a bit on the section generally. The section really was about thinking about these questions more theoretically, and so hopefully it lays down the big ideas for the rest of the book, and the interviews were also so what we do in the book is we have chapters which are normal scholarly chapters, and then we have interviews, and at the end of each sections, and we chose to interview people that can speak to the big questions of each of the sections. And so here we at the end of that section, we interview Enver Emin and Lara Deeb. And actually, we're not doing the interviews. What was really great about the project is we have graduate students that are working in the field that have done the interviews and have done the research and engage with these senior scholars. And it was really the idea of getting interviewing people that could speak to the themes of each section, but making the themes more accessible to undergraduate or policymakers through the interviews. So the interviews are made in a sense, or were designed to make these questions more accessible. And hopefully the book then becomes more accessible beyond specialists on these questions. Yeah.
Yeah, and just to build on that, to Emily's a point. They're not only scholars. They also, some of them are also scholar activists and other people in our society that are producing knowledge about Islam in Canada and elsewhere. And I think the you know, what's unique about this book is that it's on one hand more accessible, but it also brings in different voices, both as interviewee, but also as creator of knowledge in terms of our graduate students that were involved in this. So it really, we tried to be as broad and inclusive as possible.
And I think it's a fantastic idea and also opportunity to have grad students in conversation with these scholars, not only for the opportunity for building relationships, but just to kind of build continuity, right, in terms of building the next generation of scholars as well. So I did find that to be quite, I don't know, lovely. I don't know if that's the right word to say, but it was, yeah. Jennifer?
Yeah. I'm glad you noticed that, Shvana. I mean, one of the things here, I'm really grateful to the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council because we did have some funding, we were able to pay the students to really do in-depth deep dives into these scholars. So I think it was also useful because they generated in doing that kind of bibliographical and scholarly deep dive, their own questions to pose to these scholars and with our kind of supervision. So it was a kind of more long drawn out process, but I feel like it was a real pedagogical process for me too, in conversation with those students. And so it's the thing I'm actually most proud of in this volume.
Yeah, I think it's definitely a unique feature of it. And I think it would be pedagogically useful for individuals in the classroom. But I think it also, which section 3 kind of talks about, shows how people's stories and humanity matter and kind of just the production of knowledge, right? That it's just human beings doing this work. And that's important to recognize. I wonder if we could shift to section 2. And I know Jennifer and Emily, you have a chapter there with Laurie Beeman, which I think is a fantastic chapter that surveys different qualitative studies out there. And then there's a section on Sufism. So I wonder if you could say a little bit about maybe your chapter contribution in that and what the overall aims of that section generally are. Emily?
Yeah. So section 2 is, so you have section 1 is the theory, and section 2 comes and it's more empirical. And the idea with section 2 was really to sort of chart what had been written or what has been written on Islam and Muslims in Canada today, and to ask questions around that. So it's based on the empirics, still driven by theoretical question, but really based on the empirics. And so most of the contribution, all the contribution in that part do that in different ways. And so in our chapter, what we try to do is chart the trend in the literature from the 1970s to 2017. And so we analyze the different trends and what were the what has been the focus and things that have not been discussed. And so we do that through a systematic analysis of the literature. And it was a tedious exercise, now that I remember, but I think hopefully it's a helpful and useful exercise of thinking about these questions. And then we have other chapters. We have one that I want to flag that I find really interesting by Paul Eade, where he really looks at the shift that has happened in how scholars discuss Muslims in Canada, and how before 2000, the focus was mainly on ethnicity and how it became more religious. And what that does for people, not only for research, but also in the impact this has on the life of individuals and on the questions we ask as scholars. And I think that's really interesting. And maybe coming back to your first question of the podcast, I think it's something that might resonate with scholars outside of Canada, this shift and the way politics has influenced this shift.
I would just add, you know, in our chapter where we do this qualitative, it's kind of quantitative analysis of qualitative data, right? And what we tried to do was really kind of show our math equation, like not just show the answers, but show all of the work, right? And so since then, as often happens in publication, right, I've read even yesterday some fabulous work by a scholar who we did not include there, right? Because it was just missing in the bibliography. So I apologize to anyone reading whose work was not included there, but we really see this as a snapshot, right? And so this is what was kind of being written in that period. And we have some kind of projections about where research could go, but but we're really kind of looking at a moment in time. And also from our own positionalities, and I'm sure we'll get to that soon. But the other piece I wanted to really highlight is one by Sadaf Ahmed, who's a really amazing graduate student at University of Toronto. And she really posits, I think, really fascinatingly and provocatively, like, let's call for a hijab ban. There's been too much written now about the hijab. And what does that, all of that research and fetishization in its own part do to discourses on hijab, as it tries to counter the Orientalist and anti-Muslim kind of perspective? How does it also participate in it? And I think it's a really provocative and helpful question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, her chapter in the discussion of hypervisibility of the hijab in the actual scholarship and the statistics that she provided in that chapter were, I mean, not shocking, but also when it's in front of you that way, you are kind of provoked. And it's a very important contribution, which also I think contrasts with your chapter in terms of how the types of scholarship that there are. You highlighted there's not a lot of textual or theological studies as much as there are these broader questions from sociological angles about issues of assimilation or issues of integration and multiculturalism. So I think some of the gaps that are being highlighted in this section are so important. And as Amelie said, that it's not something that's applicable just for the context of Canada, but broadly, I think anybody who's studying contemporary Islam to think about like what types of scholarship and approaches people take, and maybe differences between thinking about Islamophobia versus anti-Muslim racism and things like that, right? So I do definitely think that the interventions made in these chapters are so important. Yeah.
I would just quickly say just the two interviews in this chapter. One is with Karim Karim, and he really gives an overview of his all of his contributions to thinking about Ismaili Canadians and how important that is and often overlooked. And then another interview with Abdi Kazemapour and his really important work thinking about quantitative work. And even in that quantitative work, which is so small in the corpus, how much of it is really focused on demographic questions, which also kind of poses political questions about why are we always counting? Like, what's this obsession with counting? And not other kinds of demographic questions. So around unemployment or marginalization or Islamophobia and so on.
And I think I just wanted maybe to build on what Jennifer was saying previously. So our chapter is a snapshot, really looks at the literature until 2017. And I think what's interesting is in the last 5 years, and we highlight gaps in the literature or gaps that from what the literature we've gathered. But in the past 5 years, we've seen a lot of work that have tried to start tackling some of those gaps, especially around the questions, the relationship between Islamophobia and anti-Muslim racism and have been started to think about these questions. And so we're really excited by the scholarship. And I think it was maybe 2 weeks ago, we're thinking and discussing, we're like, it would be really interesting to do another snapshot in 10 years. To see how the literature has evolved and what is now more visible and what still remains invisible. So yeah, just keep in mind that it's a snapshot and changes with time and with politics.
Yeah. Melanie?
And all of these questions are not just questions we pose to scholarship about Islam in Canada, of course, right? These are all questions that have global resonance. And so in some sense, again, we are on that, we are in the global, but we're also in the Canadian scene in some sense.
Right. Yeah. It's so hard when you're talking about Canada to make it both relevant, you know, both universal in particular, because, you know, I think as Canadian scholars, we're located and based here in whatever geography, however we think of geography. But it's also interesting to say that the relevancy needs to be universal in order for it to be valid, which I think is itself like the problematic of like doing or studying Islam in Canada. At least that's been my own experience. And so recognizing that tension in our conversation shows perhaps that there's a particular particular monopoly on scholarship on contemporary Islam in other regions that is maybe not held. But what is beautiful is, I think, with importantly with works like this, we're showcasing that actually, no, the work is there. We just need to pay attention to it and have those conversations, you know, with whoever's having those conversations, right? Sorry, that was just a little diatribe. But yeah, I don't mean to make the need for comparison, but I think it's also like there's something implicit or explicit going on, which is interesting to reflect on. The next section is on positionality, and wow, what an intense section. And I think what a wonderful group of scholars that have really contributed, you know, Rachel Brown, Hisham, like there's just, and I think what's fascinating is how vulnerable and transparent these scholars were and willing to share with their methodological process, sharing their field notes. And just, I can imagine such a great utility in terms of using these chapters and methods courses for students who are thinking about how to do ethnographic studies or any kind of methodology. So I don't know if you want to generally reflect on positionality, because I'm sure you all have these reflections in some capacity in the scholarship that you do. And a lot of it comes up in different ways throughout the chapter, and you're reflecting on who you are as human beings doing this scholarship. Or I don't know if there's any particular sections, like maybe the interview with that Yasmin Zine, that you want to highlight. But there's just, so it's just such a rich section. I think all of them are, but I was really compelled by this section, I think, just because of the vulnerability and kind of proximity and intimacy that was revealed, which is quite powerful. Yeah. Jennifer?
Yeah, I'm really grateful here we had this, I think, really powerful workshop before we launched into this volume. And one of the things that we did in that workshop was try to imagine it not as kind of a traditional one where everyone shows up with their paper and reads it. But we circulated a number of questions to people, and then we just asked them to think on those questions and then show up at the workshop. And what was really amazing was, you know, these scholars, well, maybe just speaking for myself, right? It's not easy to just show up and then hang out and talk off the cuff, right? And they really did. And I feel that that kind of experience really led itself to the kind of writing that we see in the volume. So I'm also really proud of this section and the kind of risks, I think you're right, that some of these scholars take, and then how important these questions are. And we don't all agree, and we didn't all agree at the workshop either, about who gets to speak for Islam. What does it mean? In this case, all three of us are white, and all three of us identify as non-Muslim. What does that mean, right, for a volume? Is that okay? These kinds of questions, I think, are important, and we didn't want to shy away from them. And what I'm really proud of is that in the conference or in the workshop, we had a very, I think, productive and respectful conversation where we didn't really shy away from those questions. And I think that that is visible in the product afterwards, that we're not really seeking to answer that question, but we don't want to shy away from it either.
Right. Fantastic. Yeah. Emily?
Yeah, no, and I think this question generally, this section generally actually does a very good job at thinking about the insider-outsider debate, but about blurring also the complexity of that dichotomy. And so Brown, for instance, speaks about it in her chapter and speaks it in terms of her gender as well as her whiteness. But so she speaks about it in that there's actually a complexity to the insider-outsider, which goes with the complexity of identity. And I think all the different chapter does it. Even, for instance, Roshan Jahangir or Hisham Tiflati, they use the autoethnography method in their chapter to reflect on their identities as insiders, but they also show how there might be insiders in some ways, but sometimes they're also considered as outsiders. And so how that actually unfolds in very complex ways and affects what as researchers we're able to write about, how we live it and how we see it. I think this is also a section that I'm proud of. And I think you're right about how it becomes about how scholars were ready to be vulnerable. And that perhaps makes it, that's what makes it strength in many ways. Yeah.
And to add to that and build on it, that the complexity of the insider-outsider, the complexity of identity is a really important one. And all of them have their internal dynamics in the field or as we approach a different type of different types of methodologies. And I think that's really important. And I think what we're trying to show here is exactly that complexity. So there isn't a one size fits all, you know, approach to the study of Islam. It has to be diverse. It has to be thoughtful. And I think, you know, if I hope that, you know, your listeners take anything away from the this particular conversation is that that diversity should be respected, right? And fostered that thoughtful approach to the study of Islam.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And I would imagine a section like this is really meaningful to a lot of young grad students who are doing this type of work to figure out and to acknowledge that it's okay to for it not to be clear and it's okay for it to be messy and it's okay to have these struggles. So I think that kind of visibility in scholarship is also very affirming for like scholars who are coming up now and negotiating all these identity politics and their own positionalities. So yeah, a fantastic section. The final section is shifting towards future trends, which I would love to talk about. And Melanie, you have a great chapter in this section dealing with an Islamic school in Montreal, and there was a whole legal case around it. So I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about that, and then we could also talk a little bit broadly. Yeah, I would just love to hear what your predictions are for the future of study of it.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So let me just say that in two sentences or less. No, no. I mean, I think what I'm trying to do in this chapter is to really think about what we're not saying, and specifically what scholars are not saying, right? So, in this case, there was a Montreal Islamic school that was accused of having all kinds of misogynist and otherwise quote unquote militaristic and kind of backward approaches to education, pedagogy, and culture, and this went to court and actually I talk about the legal case in the paper or the chapter, but what was more interesting to me is that who responded to the situation, who was talking about the case at the time, and who wasn't talking about the case. And it turns out that there were no scholars who were talking about it, who could actually contribute thoughtfully to a discussion about this. And so what happened in this case, you know, it turned into really an us versus them, and, you know, cast these people as such and cast us as this within the Quebec context. And my question for us as scholars is, why didn't we take that up? Why didn't we talk about that? And I include myself in that. Why didn't we contribute something to engage that conversation, that legal conversation that was happening, that was then feeding into the law, into a political discussion around, you know, private Islamic education in Canada. And I kind of want to shame us all a little bit in this chapter to say, this is the kind of conversation, given the notoriety of this case, that we need to engage in the future. We need to be part of these conversations because, gosh, evidence-based, thoughtful approaches to the study of Islam are necessary and important more than necessary and important. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah. Jen?
Yeah, I would just add, there's another, there are several great chapters, obviously, in this section, but I just also wanted to point out one by Perrine Dassa, which I think is a really beautiful ethnographic exploration about narratives and their power. So I'm particularly fond of that one as an ethnographer, but also Natasha Bakht's piece. I know I'm going to keep coming back to it. Listeners to this podcast may know about some of the controversies that have circulated around Islam and Muslims in Canada, namely recent legislation in the province of Quebec and elsewhere that aim to curtail visible or conspicuous religious signs. And Bakht here really, I think it's really fascinating, examines our Charter of Rights and Freedoms with an allusion to be or not to be. To be is within our Charter of Rights and Freedoms, and thinks about kind of legal cases around niqab. And so here I know that scholars in various other locations who want to think about those questions and often point to the Canadian context as an exemplary context. I think that Bakht's work really kind of challenges that and has, and I think will be interesting for scholars, legal scholars, who want to think creatively about ways to counteract some of those discriminations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Emily?
Just to build a little bit on what Jennifer just was saying on Bakht's chapter. So she really, she imagines, she says, okay, a lot of the cases, and that's valid, again, outside of Canada, a lot of the cases around headscarf bans or fighting headscarf bans tend to articulate their arguments around religious freedom. And then she imagines, and she says, okay, but what if we were going to articulate them around freedom of expression? What would that do? And that's really interesting because it's interesting for legal scholars, but it's also interesting for us as scholars that tend to look at questions around headscarf with the lens of religion. And what would that do if we would look at it as a freedom of expression? Would it open new ways of seeing things and of imagining? And so that's a bit what we're trying to do with that section, is we're really trying to see, okay, if we ask the questions a bit differently with different angles, what then can we write about? Can we think about, and how would this actually end up also having impact in policy or more generally on how society thinks about these questions? I also wanted to highlight Haltman's chapter, because there she's using mixed methods. She's using qualitative and quantitative together, which is also something that's, first of all, very difficult to do and very rare, but it produces new questions and new ways of thinking. And so hopefully this section also for scholars is also an eye opener for maybe new scholars working on Islam and Muslims in Canada and outside of Canada to think outside the box in many ways, or outside the ways we've been looking at these questions. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Melanie, did you want to add something?
Or? Yeah. So the future trends. So it's not so much, future trends is not so much about predicting what is going to happen in the study of Islam in the future. It's more about what would happen if we thought differently, right? So that's really what we're posing in this piece. And, you know, and we do that from a methodological perspective. We do that from a legal perspective. You know, we're trying to crisscross knowledge systems. And I think the interview with Catherine Bullock is really important, because here, what we're really saying here is the activist scholarly path is also a really important one to recognize and to understand and to hold up as a system of knowledge as well. And so, so I kind of piece of this as well.
Great. Yeah. I mean, do you have any reflections of where you see like some trajectories? You spent a lot of time working on this. You provided us a snapshot, and so you must have been quite meta to be providing a snapshot, but also seeing trajectories of scholarship. As you're saying, you kind of stopped at 2017, and in the last 5 years, so much has happened, and there's a lot of students writing dissertations and things like that. Do you have a personal sense of where you would like to see some shifts or realignments as kind of like a continuity of this final section, Jennifer.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I know, like, just speaking for myself, this meta thinking, as you're saying, it's been really generative. Amelia and I, with one of our contributors, Anver Eamon, have thought about this, what we're calling a Muslims in Canada archive. Mm-hmm. So it's really like creating an archive, which I've also taken up here in my own institution for Muslims in Newfoundland and Labrador. Mm-hmm. So establishing kind of a historical record with which then we can think about history, right? And so it's kind of like three steps back, I guess, from the historical work that needs to be done is actually gathering and thinking about those archival records. So that's one piece. And I know also that how important it is in this moment, maybe in Canada, where we're seeing the rise of visibility of white supremacy, other kinds of thinking around Canada as a nation state, as a white settler state, and thinking through those kinds of questions vis-a-vis Muslim life in Canada as well. So I anticipate that many scholars are going to be taking up those lines of questions, or hope that they do.
I think Jennifer said it very well. But I think that what I'm seeing already now in new scholarship and in dissertation is really this idea of thinking about questions around Islamophobia, but also clearly with a critical race approach, and thinking theoretically of what that means. Because I think it was before there was work on that, but now it's really theoretically and conceptualizing these concepts that's starting to be done by new scholars. And this is very promising and really interesting. And it's also related to the moment we're in, the political moment. So it's a reflection of the political moment, but that new scholarship wasn't as developed previously, and it's being developed now by new scholars. So I'm really looking forward to reading that work and thinking with them and through their work on those questions.
I think what I'm seeing so far, they're thinking a lot about the effects of certain policies. So they're getting away from questions around veil and veiling, etc., which I think is a deep emphasis, right? If you look at the bibliography, but really looking at the effects of certain policies and laws now on people's everyday realities and the movement. And so I think that's going to be very rich. I think that's going to be very interesting work. And so the way that that's going to be absorbed and fostered is going to be really interesting to watch and be a part of.
I think it's fascinating to think of the future trajectories of the things that people are doing. Even as your the chapters have highlighted, the pivot towards thinking very intentionally about race is important, which has also prompted reflection in the past and thinking about Black Islam in Canada, which, you know, I'm sure the archive exists. I know it does. It's just a matter of, I think, scholars intentionally going into the archives and looking for those things specifically, right? And I think that it's fantastic to see what new generation of scholars will be doing and asking those important questions, but also taking scholarship or theoretical works that are happening in other fields and bringing it into kind of thinking about Islam in Canada, right? And I see that in terms of the conversation, in terms of future trends, like how can we rethink this question in a different way, right? What kind of tools and mechanisms can we utilize that already exists, right? And I think that's really, really exciting. That's fantastic. I have a bit of a different question for you all. I'm sure there's many folks out there who may be embarking on editing volumes together. You three have a fantastic relationship and seem to like each other. And so I want to know, do you have any advice for folks who are thinking, hey, I'm going to edit a project? Usually, you know, folks say don't do it because it's a lot of work and you have committed a lot to this. But I mean, the fruits of the labor is that you've done something amazing and a huge service. So, I mean, what are the do's and don'ts, I guess, of editing a project together, holding a workshop together, writing an amazing, you know, collaborating on an amazing volume together? Do you have any advice for listeners? I mean, you're all smiling.
So. Yeah, we're smiling. Just choose your collaborators wisely. I'm sure your listeners know, right? Even from group projects in elementary school, some of them work better than others. And I know for me, like one of the elements of this book that I think tied us together is also our deep commitment and longstanding work in this area, but also just the patience it took because, you know, part of this, the writing kind of took place before the pandemic, but there's certainly ways in which all of us have been affected by the pandemic, everyone in the volume. And so when I think that some of the writing here was written in 2017, mm-hmm. You know, it's been a very long journey through peer review, through publication and everything. So it's just kind of holding the course. And I'm really grateful to, I think we have 22 chapters here. It's a lot of people to marshal and everyone was really committed to the project. So really grateful for that. So I don't know if that's advice, but it worked out. So I'm really grateful.
Yeah. To echo, so it's in terms of the leadership between the three of us, choose wisely. I feel I certainly did, and I was really enriched by this process. And it's, you know, as you know, we started in 2016, and you know we're now in 2022. So, you know, it's 6 years in. And so for 6 years, I feel that I've had the opportunity and the privilege to be in conversation, certainly with my co-editors, but also the other contributors. But on the everyday, of course, it was the three of us that were, you know, organizing, pivoting, you know, trying to find funding for different aspects of the editorial process. And I feel so grateful because it really, really matters who you work with. And both on a technical level, but all on, and so I just feel very grateful that I've had these 6 years, and I hope to have other projects with both in the future, because it really has been enriching for me to work with both of them. So they've taught me so much. So just a little thank you and high five to both of you.
Emily?
Yeah, no, I think I just, I'm going to reiterate what everyone said, but I think it's if you choose wisely, collaboration for me is amazing because you learn from others. You, first of all, you're not by yourself with your project, lonely, becoming crazy because you're doing all this research and you don't know, you have a group of peer and you can actually, with whom you can speak to and share things. So that's really good. But then you also learn. And I think in this project, for instance, we supervise students together and I learned from Melanie, I learned from Jennifer on how they were supervising students and how to supervise and how to help students grow through the volume and things that I didn't really know and haven't, you know, you're not necessarily, this is not something you are necessarily taught about. So that was really a great piece that I think collaboration really, if you choose wisely, makes it really worthwhile. You also learn, we all come from similar, but a bit different disciplines. So you also learn the different the styles of disciplines. And that's been helpful as well. The other thing is the piece of advice is just that it's patient. You need patience. And I here again, I'm grateful for all the people that collaborated, that they've stayed with us because it took a very long time. And it was also long because the book is a big one. And so to get reviews for that type of book and to get people that have time to review took a very long time. So patience and perseverance is key, but if you choose wisely, it works. Yeah.
One contributor I will not name, we actually got his author agreement. We tracked him down. He was driving across Canada. He was at a gas station in Saskatchewan when he finally submitted it, right? So we were dogged. We got everyone. We got it all done. And yeah, so it's a really trans-Canada edited volume.
I love that. That's amazing. That's like a Canadian story. That's really cool. I mean, it really is a testament to the labor and the commitment that you had for this topic and for this project. But also, I think what as a reader, when I read it, I felt like, oh, I have a community. Like I didn't, you know, I think as a scholar who works on Islam and Muslims in Canada, I don't often think that there's like a real community because we're all kind of all over the place and there might not always be spaces where we gather. And so I think looking through the table of contents, it was a good reminder that they do exist. And so especially now when networking and conferencing is not as possible, I think it's helpful for folks, especially PhD students, grad students coming up to know that there are folks, and this would serve as a resource in that way, that if you need to find people, you could kind of start here, right? Which I think is great. Yeah. So as we're wrapping up, I don't know if there's anything else that you wanted to mention. I know it's a huge volume. There's no way we were able to get to all of it. And hopefully this has enticed our listeners to pick up the volume. But are there any final thoughts you want to get across before we say goodbye? Jennifer, yeah.
I'll just really quickly do a shout out to the group of folks who are organizing CASM. Mm. It's the Canadian Association for the Study of Islam, I think, and Muslims in Canada, or anyway, we'll have to look up the acronym, but that did not exist, right, back when we were first putting together this bibliography. And so to me, it's really exciting and a new moment for the study of Islam and of Muslims in Canada. So I'm really excited about that.
Fantastic. Yeah. Emily?
Yeah, and I think it's one of the reasons we were able to do this volume is also because the field of Muslims and Islam or people working on these questions in Canada is still rather small. So it's small, but, you know, it's growing. And so that's one of the reasons we were able to do this book. And I think Kazim probably will also participate to gathering these scholars and creating a community. So there is a community. And I think because it's small, it's a chance for it to be maybe tighter and for all of us to know each other, which comes out in this volume, but hopefully will come out as well in other initiatives afterwards.
Yeah, and I think this leads us actually back to the start of the interview, which is why we started this, why we were part of this kind of what may become a movement. It looks like it is becoming a movement that we do. It is important to think about how Islam and Muslims are framed by the domestic context and nationalism in all of its contested ways. And so just a few years ago in 2016, you know, this idea of community didn't really exist in the study of Islam and Muslims in Canada. And Jennifer and I started a listserv, 350 scholars working on Islam in Canada, so that we can have those challenging, good discussions about this field and to, you know, make sure that we incorporate those diverse voices that are working in this field.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is wonderful to see a lot of these shifts. Yeah, absolutely. Are there any projects we could expect from you from the future that's, you know, continuing any of this? Is there going to be a volume two? Like what's coming down the pipeline, either individually or collaboratively? You're like, no. Well, of course you should celebrate this first before you think. I'm sure there's things you're working on that our listeners might want to know about. So Jennifer, do you have something or anything that you're working on?
Yeah, thanks for asking, Shimana. That's kind. So I'm just working on finishing a book on a different ethnographic project looking at transnationalism and secularism in France and Canada with attention to Algerian experience, so many of whom are Muslim. And yeah, just thinking more about, you know, the secular and so on. But I still do a lot of teaching and I guess you could say activist work related to Islamophobia and Muslim life in Canada. So definitely keeping my foot in that scholarship and activist work as well.
Fantastic. Yeah. Emily?
So I think my work has been and is now becoming more and more about thinking about the politics of secularism, and it has always been, and I think now I'm going toward that even more. So we have Jennifer and myself are starting a new project where we want to think about the politics of secularism and questions around race in Quebec. So we'll be thinking about that. And then volume two, I don't know about that, but I think the more after this discussion and other discussions we had since the book came out, the more I think it would be really important and interesting to do another snapshot in maybe 10 or 15 years. So whether it's us that do it or another group of scholars, maybe, but I think these snapshots are important, not only for scholars in the field, but also for scholars, I don't know, in 100 years that want to see snapshots. I think this hopefully will be really helpful. So this is a project that should happen. Whether it's us or others, I don't know, but yes, yeah.
Fantastic. And Melanie, what are you working on?
I'm actually just starting on a big project that once this podcast is released will have been announced, I think. And it is the university sector response to the crisis in Afghanistan. And I'm working with a team of scholars at risk, human rights defenders, and activists and residents to think and rethink about integration, welcome, and knowledge preservation in contexts of crisis. And so that's what I'll be focusing very intensely on over the next few years, in addition to my own work on Muslim youth. So.
Fantastic. Yeah. Before I let you go, I forgot to mention one thing. I didn't know if somebody wanted to speak to the cover, the beautiful art that's on the cover. I should have highlighted that from the beginning, but as I'm like getting ready to say goodbye, I'm like, oh no, I forgot this one important thing. Because I think it's beautiful. And I think the reason it's chosen is really in line with the broader aims of the project. So perhaps that's a good way to end our conversation today. Who would like to say something? I don't know. Jennifer, do you want to go?
Go for it. So thanks for that question, Shabana, and thanks for noticing the cover. We're really proud of it. I do think covers are important. And so we were really thrilled. What we decided to do amongst the three of us, and I think it was Melanie who actually found this artist, was to just kind of take a look by Google search or by through networks of young artists, not even young, but artists in Canada who do something related to Islam or Muslims in Canada. So we really took our time to kind of choose this person. And we came across Aman Sattar, who's an Ottawa-based calligrapher, who's been a really kind of an emerging artist. And what was really fun about it was that she seemed kind of surprised that we reached out to her and was really thrilled. I hope this will give some visibility to her work and encourage your podcast listeners. If you just kind of go onto Instagram and write in her name, her last name is spelled Sattar, you can find more of her calligraphic work and I think an artist to watch.
Oh, that's fantastic. It's a beautiful cover. And I know University of Toronto Press often does very great job with the cover and the production process. So this is it was great. Yeah. Well, I'm so grateful for your time. I know it's so busy. Most of all, congratulations to you on this fantastic project. I hope you're taking time to celebrate. And thank you for the great service that you've done for scholars like us in Canada to think about Islam in Canada. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having us. Yeah. It was an amazing discussion. Really
absolutely.
Thank
you. Generous. Thank you, Shana.
Thank you. Yes. And thank you for this whole series. It's just fantastic.
And that was my conversation with Amelie, Jennifer, and Melanie about their new edited volume, Producing Islams in Canada. Hope you'll pick up the book. And thank you again for joining us for this episode. And I hope you'll join me again next time. Until then, stay well and stay safe. Bye.